Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today is March 9th, 2017. It is 1:40, and with us today we have Senator Gardner. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I grab just a moment and put on the record that I've been delegated to say that your staff did a fabulous job in getting us our materials for today.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Weston has been a great aid for the committee. I'd also like to welcome Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hughes, the Vice Chair.
Good afternoon.
And Senator Stevens, welcome. Today we will be considering governor's appointees to state boards and commissions, and we have several individuals who are calling in for that, and also somebody here in person. Welcome. Then following that, we will have the first hearing of Senate Bill 56, which was introduced by Senator Giesel. So today, as I mentioned, we'll be looking at a series of governor's appointments to boards and commissions. I want to thank all the nominees for your time and for serving the state of Alaska. Many of these are reappointments. It's really important to have Alaskans involved in our state government. Confirmation hearings are often the only time the legislature gets to dialogue with these boards, and it helps us better understand the issues that they're facing. Senators, we have appointee bios and background information in your packet, and so we will be bringing the members up one at a time to call in, and we will have an opportunity to hear from them, to take any of your questions, then to take any public testimony, and we will be setting aside all the nominations and moving them all forward at the same time. We have several dozen that the committee we'll be looking at. So today is just the beginning of the process. So with that, the first board that we will be looking at is the Alaska State Board of Public Accountancy. This is a 7-member board, and the nominee that we are hearing from today is Mara Beltrami of Anchorage. Are you online? Hey, I don't see her.
I am.
Oh, she is. Great. Thank you so much. You are filling the CPA PA seat on the Board of Public Accountancy, and I want to thank you for joining us. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and then let the committee members know your interest in serving on this board, please.
My name is Maria Beltrami, and Beltrami and Associates in Anchorage. I've been a CPA for over 20 years, and my interest in serving on this board is my interest in my profession that has served me well over the years, and I own my own small business with 6 employees. Some of those employees, I hope, are my succession plan, and I want to serve my industry and keep it moving forward and be a part of that leadership and ensuring a good future for my staff as they embark down the same road that I went.
Well, thank you, Maria, for being available today and also for your interest in serving on the board. Are there any particular challenges that you see that the state, that the board will be addressing in the coming year?
No, I know the board has addressed a few changes over the past few years, and I'm not aware of any major new changes coming down the pipeline.
Okay. Do members have any questions for the nominee? Senator Gardner.
Thank you, and thank you, Maria, for your willingness to serve. Can you talk just briefly about the possible conflict of interest given the business that you own and the work with the Board of Public Accountancy?
I don't know that I guess the potential interest that I could benefit from would be any decisions or anything that comes through the Board of Accountancy that affects public accountancy will affect my firm, whether it's positive or negative, because I'm subject to any and all of those decisions. So that's why I answered yes, that I may potentially benefit from any decisions that the board would have, as would any CPA that sits on the board that's in current practice.
Senator Gardner?
Thank you, and thank you. Yeah, that's really true, and I see that 5 of the 7 members are CPAs, that
yeah.
we can tell. So, and it's understandable. Obviously, you're going to find people who work in the field and have an interest and expertise in it who volunteer for service. So I just wanted to kind of give you a chance to talk about that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Is there any member of the public that wishes to provide public testimony on this governor's nominee to the State Board of Public Accountancy, Mariah Beltrami? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much for calling in. As I mentioned, we will be keeping public testimony open and holding the application and moving them all forward at the same time. So thank you very much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Next, a nominee for the public seat is Wayne Hogue of Kotzebue. Wayne, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome. Certainly appreciate you taking time to make yourself available to the committee. Please state your name and your affiliation for the record and let the committee members know your interest in serving in this capacity.
My name is Wayne Hogue. I work for Manelik Association. I'm a public member. I don't have any CPA affiliations, so I don't have any conflict of interest. I'm interested in serving it. I just want to do my civic duty. The governor's office contacted me and found my application for other boards and said I would be a good fit and asked me if I would serve, and I obliged, and brings me here.
Great, and I see that you have passed service on the Kotzebue Alcohol Beverage Control Board the first 2 years that it was in existence. So you're
yes, I helped implement the liquor store, the first city-owned liquor store here in Alaska.
Okay.
That was a very interesting work, but it gave me good experience with setting up rules and regulations for the alcohol board, and that translates over. We're currently working on bringing Alaska, we want reciprocity between states, and we're working to bring our regs in line with the rest of the nation. That's our big project. It's on the board, on the table right now.
Well, thank you for that, and that certainly there's always a learning curve when you join a board, but you have that kind of experience, and I think that'll serve you well. Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to ask you, Mr. Hogue, are the most of the meetings of the of this board by audio conference, or are they face-to-face meetings?
Well, we've struggled with that. My first meeting was audio conference, but it's very hard to participate in all the activities. We review applicants for CPA licensing here in the state, and those are physical files, and so I could not participate. Our next meeting, I did go to Juneau. We were meeting with some legislators there on some changes that we need to make, and I was able to attend in person there, and that was very productive. I actually got to go through applicants and applications for the license and participate in that. And we're planning on trying to get permission to bring me into the meeting because I am remote, and I think most everybody else is on the road system, with the exception of one lady that's in Juneau. They're going to work to bring me down for the meetings, for our quarterly meetings.
Well, very good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hogan. I assume that, and I agree with you, that face-to-face meetings are so much better. I assume this does not cause you a hardship to attend occasional meetings.
Absolutely not. Manelik has given me permission to serve on the board, and I have no problem me and the obligations. I have plenty of personal leave, and that's not a problem. So yeah, it's really no problem at all.
Thank you, Shogun. Thanks for applying.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And you also have now a question from Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Wayne, for being willing to step up. It was kind of funny because as Senator Stevens was asking the question regarding attending in-person meetings and you were mentioning that, I happened to glance down at your employment history, and it looks like you are doing technical kind of work with computers and such, and then I see your virtualization consultant. What is that?
Well, virtualization is consolidating computer resources into centralized stack, and basically, like at Manili, we run 300 desktops on our system, and they're all running on a set of four servers. They're all being served up from there. And then all of our services are also virtualized. It's really the way of the future. Saves energy, and you get maximum use out of your resources because you can consolidate it, pack it all in there, and use every little bit of the resource. I've been doing that for, well, I was an original beta tester for VMware back before they were, before anybody knew them back in the 90s. And I've been involved in virtualization ever since. It's very powerful tool. I can see where there's lots of things that could be done in the state government with it, but that's not up to me.
Senator Hughes?
And so the idea of a virtual meeting where you, instead of just audio conference, where you would be able to actually have synchronous video teleconferencing, is that something that is involved with what you do? And would that be a possibility for some of the boards in our state? Just while we've got you online, I just thought I'd ask.
Well, that is a possibility. In this case, until we can get all the documents digitized and get everything digitized where they can be distributed to the board members digitally for us to review, you know, for the license applications, it's really not applicable. But yeah, we use teleconferencing extensively here in the medical area where we have we got a patient that's got difficulties out in the village. They can actually fire up a teleconference with doctors down in Anchorage, and the doctor can interact with the patient there over the video and with the assistance of the clinician there in the clinic. They can perform some procedures and that, and it's all guided by the video conference. But that's something that's very possible. Something like a WebEx would be very powerful to enhance, because with the audio meetings, you don't really, you gotta kind of follow along with your own paperwork, but in a WebEx, which is a shared meeting, the person that's talking can share their desktop and point out exactly what they're looking at, and you can see what they're looking at, follow along. It's a much better way. We use it on a daily basis with IT support. Almost all of my vendors, whenever I have a technical issue with one of my vendors' products, we start up a WebEx session. They connect and they can look right at my system, see exactly what I'm seeing, and we can interact with each other and share each other's desktops and applications. And it's got the audio built into it, and I believe you can do some video as well. That's certainly something, and we've discussed this in our committee. It's like, oh, this would be such a powerful thing if we had some kind of web meeting application such as WebEx. There's lots of them out there. They were the first WebEx and very popular one, but there's other products out there. But that would greatly enhance virtual meetings, especially in this time when we're trying to save on travel, because travel, like I said, it wouldn't be necessary for a lot of things. In the case of ours, yeah, it's still necessary with the physical files that we have to review. But I believe we've got plans on getting that all digitized, so at some point in time, I'd be able to take a teleconference and be able to go through the files as well instead of dropping out at the conference.
Thank you, Wayne. Are there any further questions, Senator?
Just thank you, and perhaps you could help usher that in for our many boards and commissions to save travel money some in the near future. Thank you.
I would love to. That's certainly a possibility. I could ramble. You guys don't want to hear me ramble on, I'm sure, but I could ramble on about technology forever. I could eat up the rest of your day.
Well, thank you for making yourself available.
Very pro technology, and here at Neelig, we run the bleeding edge stuff. We've always been very staying up with the very latest stuff. So it amazes me. I go to other places, and it's like, oh wow, they're not even near the technical level we are. And
so Wayne,
level 48.
Wayne, we do need you to wrap up, and I appreciate you taking questions. I'd like to find out, is there anybody online or here in Juneau who would like to provide public testimony on Wayne Hoag's nomination to this board? Okay, seeing none. Thank you again for making yourself available. I will be keeping public testimony open for this nominee, as with all of them. Next, Donovan Rulian of Anchorage, thank you for joining us. I see you're online. So if you would be so happy or, explain your interest in continuing to serve on this board. I see that you have a long history of public service and goes back to being involved in the PTA of Romig and Turnagain Elementary School. You've been involved with the Boys and Girls Club, Campfire. You've worked with Crime Stoppers. I mean, certainly your public service has been pretty significant, and I want to give you a chance to explain your interest in continuing to serve on the board.
My name is Don Rulian, and thank you for having me. My wife and I moved up here 33 years ago and raised three children here, and we thought it was important to be part of the community, to give back to the community, if you want to say that. And I've been on the state board. My first term just finished up, and I'm currently the chair of the board. And I enjoy doing that. I've been president of the Alaska Society of CPAs. I've been a member of council for the American Institute of CPAs. And I'm currently serving on a committee, a national committee for the Uniform Accountancy Act for the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy. And the nice thing about all these boards that I've been on is it gives me a great background to help serve the Alaska, basically licensees, if you want. And one of the things we stress the most is everything we do has to be something that protects the public. And it's difficult sometimes because people want to push back on many of the regulations or that we're trying to push forward and become more in line with the rest of the country, because everyone wants to be protective of their credentials, if you want to call that, or their business and things. But we always look back and say, well, what is best to protect the public? Because if we can show that, and the public believes that we're doing our best job of protecting them, then our credential will stand as one of the best credentials in the world, the CPA.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, are there any questions for Donovan? Senator Gardner.
Thank you. And of all the appointments that this committee is going to review, I think there's almost 60 of them. You're the only one who lives in my district, so I want to take a moment to thank you. And also, I see that you have a sheet here, or we have, of cases in which you've been an expert witness. And
yes, I'm also a certified evaluation analyst.
Okay, so I was just kind of wondering if a lot of these were divorce cases. And
the sad thing is, yes. And usually most of the work we do before, within the courts or mediation is going to be a divorce case, or to evaluate one of the spouse's businesses in order to come up with a fair valuation so they can split the amounts between the spouses.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. And thank you for your service.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone here in Juneau or online who would wish to provide public testimony on this nominee's appointment to the board? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Donovan, for making yourself available. Appreciate the service that you've provided the state. Next, we will be looking at a nominee for the Fisherman's Fund Advisory and Appeals Council, and we have a nominee from Ketchikan, Clay Bezanek. This council consults with the commissioner or designee regarding negative decisions on appeals filed in relation to care of sick and disabled fishermen, and it also advises the department on administration of the fund. So with that, Clay, welcome, and please feel free to give comments and introduce yourself to the committee.
Hey, good afternoon there, committee, or chairman of committee. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Well, very good. I'm on my cell phone here in town, so... yeah, I just wanted to say thanks for serving yourselves, and I've been on the panel there, the appeals board, for 11 years, and I'm honored to be on there. I'm a 34-year commercial fisherman, and health concerns are huge for a fleet, as we're kind of graying, but don't tell that many people about it. But the health care is huge, and the Fisherman's Fund was started in 1951 and before statehood, and one of the guys that started it was from Ketchikan. So it's kind of an honor to be nominated again to be on there. Actually, it's pretty cool. What we do pretty much as fishermen is, you know, we all know people in our district, and everybody that's on the board is a fairly long time fisherman. So we have this local knowledge, historical knowledge, and then we've all pretty much fished in different areas of the state. So there's nobody that pretty much we don't know. So it's kind of a cool thing. And it's helpful to the process. And then, our board that's on there right now is we have a really good mix, and we just lost a long-term guy from Seward a couple years ago. Jim Herbert was his name. And he was the grandpa, and so we've kind of transferred this historical knowledge down the line. We went to this fisherman's cost, healthcare costs have gone up. We came to the legislature a few years ago and had our limit increased from $2,500 to $10,000, and that's worked okay. The fund hasn't lost a lot of money. And then we also found we knew this little way that people were scamming scamming the licensing fees by getting these one-day licenses or seven-day licenses, for a couple different fisheries. So we again asked the legislature to help us out in that matter. So we've been kind of proactive and we've been really proactive, actually. So it's been an honor for me to serve, and I just appreciate that living in a state that we can affect affect our industries in such a way. And the guys that had the foresight to start the Fisherman's Fund in 1951, my hat's off to them. Mm-hmm. So that's about all I got.
Thank you very much, Clay. You have a question from Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you help us understand, Clay, what you're actually dealing with? So these are decisions by someone. A fisherman has been injured in some way or sick, and a negative decision has been reached on his coverage, and you are involved after that point. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's basically it. There's a series of criteria that if he doesn't apply on time, or if he doesn't fill out his paperwork correctly, or there's a number of reasonings, and this has occurred over time, all these different regulations that have been put in there, to protect the fund. And that's kind of what we are. We don't want anybody to scam the fund. And then at the same time, we want to help people. So that's kind of what we are. We look at things after the general criteria has not been met. Then it comes to us, and we look at each case individually and by the merits of the case, and that's how we work, yeah.
Well, thank you, Clay. I appreciate your service.
Clay, it looks like you have a fellow board member, Mark Saldi, who's called in from Skagway. Mark, are you interested in providing public testimony for Clay's nomination to the Fisherman Fund Advisory and Appeals Council?
Yeah, I'm calling it as an individual, speaking for myself, not for the board.
Oh, okay.
I've worked with, been on the board with Clay for 9 years, and he's a top-notch guy, you know. He likes to get things done. And, if we have a question on one of the claims or reviewing or something, you'll just call to find out the information, whether to the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission or to the fisherman himself, just to get some answers so we can make a decision. You know, kicking the thing down to the next meeting cycle. And besides that, Clay, he knows just about everybody in the state when it comes to fishing. So, anyways, I just recommend you reappoint him, and that's what I have to say.
Thank you. Appreciate you calling in. It's always nice to have people provide that public testimony. Is there anyone here in Juneau who wishes to testify?
Yep. Got to keep the rug there.
Welcome. The
rug. Madam Chair, my name is Jerry McKean. I represent United Fishermen Alaska. Since Jim's retired and Seward, that he talked about Jim Hubert, that Clay's probably the oldest member on there that understands what's going on with the insurance, and did they have all those claims they have to review in case they're not valid claims and on this dedicated fund. So we support Clay's reappointment because I think it's very essential to the council to have somebody that has that experience on there to teach you other folks that are coming in too or don't have enough experience on there, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and I agree. I think that continuity is really vital, especially with these smaller boards. Senator Stevens?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say that I thought Jerry was going to come here and complain about the comment about the graying of the fleet.
Well, I haven't used the fund, but you have to be first. You have to use your own insurance if you have insurance. But, you know, a lot of crew guys that we pay the money in from the crew and the fees that go in on limit entry, and a lot of guys don't have that health insurance. You know, you got to be under the $10,000. But, yeah, the grain of fleet, I don't like that subject too well because I'm not ready to quit fishing, and I'll probably fish for the whatever I can as long as I'm healthy. So maybe the Fisherman Fund will help me out in the future in that regard.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? All right. Well, Clay, thank you very much for making yourself available, and we will keep the public testimony open and be forwarding all the names at one time. So, again, thank you for your service to the state.
You bet. Thank you.
Next, we have Lana Bell, who is here in the room. Welcome. Please feel free to join us. She has been nominated to the 7-member board of the Board of Pharmacy and to the pharmacist seat. And certainly our committee has heard a lot of legislation lately related to pharmacists, so I know that you're just as busy as we are. So I want to welcome you, and please feel free to introduce yourself to the committee and tell us why you're interested in serving, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
My name is Lana Bell, and I have worked in pharmacy. I was licensed here in 1988, fresh out of college. I came up with the Public Health Service to intern and met my husband, who's a born and raised Alaskan. I worked at Cars for forever, and then I also had a stint at Teamster Mall Pharmacy. So my career was in retail, and then I have taken a job with I currently work for the state at Pioneer Home Pharmacy, and I've worked there for 14 years, which is institutional experience. I think I bring a broad range of experience. I started in pharmacy when I was 12, working for my uncle, and he had two pharmacies in the state of Georgia, which I have a big family back there. I always expected to work for him, but he got a divorce my senior year in college, and his wife got the pharmacies. So, you know, that was a change for me and a plan B, which I just was really, I loved Alaska. Met my husband, moved here. So I actually started, I was licensed in Alaska right out of college. Started working at Cars when I was 23 years old. So I feel like I've my entire career, Alaska has provided me with great opportunities, and I'm grateful for that. Alaska supported me, and I am doing this to support Alaska. I've always had some kind of something going on the side. I was a Girl Scout leader and taught Sunday school, and this is my first year as an empty nester. It's very sad. And I thought, you know, this opportunity was there, and I thought that would be a good way for me to give back to my to the pharmacy. I also served on the board of the Pharmacy Association for a period of time, several years. And we have all kinds of things going on with the Board of Pharmacy, and they have to have one member on the Controlled Substance Advisory Committee, which is the governor's, not committee, council, I guess it is, has law enforcement, it has several doctors on the committee, and then a Board of Pharmacy member, which I have been participating in that since August, and that has been very interesting. But one thing that you have to realize is that pharmacists are on the front lines, and so this is an important topic for us. I mean, I say that you get a PhD in psychology just being a pharmacist when you have people coming to the pharmacy and they're desperate for their medicines, whatever it is, and you're the first people that folks see when they get bad news, you know, and so we serve the community just through our jobs, and you have to be a caring person to do a good job, but you also have to be willing to say no, and that's hard, and you also have to, I've always had to work closely with law enforcement because, you know, when I worked retail, we had a lot of forgers that would come in and so on and so forth, and you just really realize how far people will go to how awful this opioid epidemic is, and how we do have to wrap our arms around it, but it's a complicated issue. And so I'm finding that through the Board of Pharmacy, and once again, I'm on the front lines of this in a different way, and it's extremely interesting, and it's rewarding to contribute what I can to the effort. And I'm glad that it is something that's on the radar now, because it's not really a new problem. It's just out of control now, and we do have to figure out what to do about it. But you also don't want to limit people who need treatments from getting the treatments that they need, and that's really important. And so it's a balance there. I certainly don't want to have a condition and need help and can't get what I need. So, but it's, once again, it's not really anything new. It's just, what are we going to do about it? And, of course, you see the issues like that every day, but this is something that I can personally contribute to.
Well, I want to thank you for making the trip here. Personally, I'm very humbled by the process of looking through all the nominees, because really, you said it best. I mean, you're on the front lines, and not just for the pharmacists, but for a lot of professions here. So I want to thank you for your willingness to serve and, you know, what you contribute to the state. And are there questions from committee members? Senator Gardner?
Thank you, and thank you also for your service. In your role as a member of the Board of Pharmacy or as part of the Controlled Substance Advisory Council, are you able to testify on proposed legislation that can impact your work, or at the state level or at the federal level?
I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. Seems like you would have some expertise that could be valuable when the legislature contemplates things that impact this, and we've got, you know, this massive opioid addiction problem that you've referenced.
Well, I'm certainly available as a resource at any time. I don't know whether I can testify. I would have to ask. I try not to do anything out of order, but I'm always available as a resource.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Hughes.
Yes, since you're here, you mentioned that you believe the problem, the opioid problem, has always been there, but it's out of control. Can you give us an idea of the increase in frequency that you're seeing people walk up to your counter compared to maybe 5 years ago?
Certainly. I no longer work retail, so I'm not on, I'm not seeing it every day from my perspective. In an institutional pharmacy, it's a more controlled environment. And so our goal in an institution is to make sure that our residents are not having to suffer needlessly. And it's a whole different, geriatric medicine is different. You want a person who is in decline to have what they need. And in a controlled environment, you're not going to have abuse. In the retail setting, I have many friends who are pharmacists, and so I hear about what's going on now. And it's, like I said, you just have to be, you learn to say no, but you have to be diplomatic in your saying no. There are many people, drug seekers, who are out there, but the street drugs are the problem right now. And so when I say it's out of control, I wouldn't say that pharmacies are seeing drug seekers coming to the pharmacy wanting prescription drugs. We're seeing the fallout from street drug use and how it damages a person and how they need help after, how they need help, rehabilitation, I guess is the word. Am I making sense? We're seeing what happens to people when they've had a lifetime or even a short time abusing street drugs, which is scary.
Senator Hughes?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So you're not, I know you're not doing retail, and I'm sorry, I forgot that when I first asked the question. So you're not seeing where maybe it used to be once a week you had a drug seeker come in to try to game the system, and now retail pharmacists are seeing five a day. So you're not, sounds like you're not seeing that. But can you tell me, are you seeing an increase in prescriptions that are being offered patients of with an opioid base that more than we saw a number of years ago, or is that, say, pretty steady?
I think that providers are very sensitive now. When I say providers, I mean prescribers of drugs. I see that they, I had to see an orthopedic surgeon recently, personally, and he said that, you know, in the 1990s, they were encouraged to prescribe pain medicines. We didn't want anybody in pain in our nation, and that backfired to some degree. And so now he said, you know, we don't prescribe as many pain medicines. I went to a DEA conference that was a day-long conference about a month ago, and they said, okay, so you give someone a drink of alcohol every day for 3 weeks, and a certain percentage of the people that you've given the prescribed drink to will become an alcoholic. If you give an opioid every day to someone for 3 weeks, a certain percentage of those people will become abusers or become addicted. Addicted is the word. So you have a kid that's hurt in a game of hockey, and they have to take these drugs, and through no fault of their own, you know, they're hurt and they need help. They become addicted after 3 weeks, and they have to fight that forever. And so it's not that the prescribers were doing anything wrong. It's that we have evolved through where we are today is that we recognize that you have to be really careful with these drugs because long-term impact is, I think we just now have information. We're just now there where we realize that this is a problem. And so I see that providers are very sensitive to it now. You'll always have your pill mill guys, but we don't. A reputable doctor who has an established practice in a community is not wanting to do that. And with the PDMP, we're getting records in real time regarding the prescribing practices throughout our state. But for the most part, in my experience, all of us go to school for a long time. We're professionals in our field, and we don't want to abuse that. And we want to help people. It's just, like I said, it's a balancing act. You want someone to have what they need, but you want them to get better. You know, if you break a leg, you want the person to heal. And so it's a balance. It's just everybody's individual, and I think the most providers are very conscientious.
Thank you. Thank you, Lana. Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lana, for coming down here to Juneau. I'm assuming you're from Anchorage or from the Valley?
I live in Anchorage. I'm on Esquire Drive.
Okay.
For years.
Oh, you do?
Yes, I do.
I grew up on Esquire Drive.
I guess that's somewhere in West Anchorage, right?
It is, right on West High.
Okay. You know, we talked about the opioids and the challenges that you have as a pharmacist with that. Granted, you're in the with the Pioneer Home now. So, and then also, I know we started insisting that some of the sinus medicine also be put behind the counter, which impacts you because we found out they were using some of that to make meth. And but I guess my bigger question and my experience with pharmacists has been just the nightmare you have with insurance companies. Now, granted, with the Pioneer Home, you're probably mostly working Medicare, so maybe insurance isn't such a nightmare for you. But it seems like when I go, they're always changing the rules. It's like, well, instead of a 90-day supply, you can only get 30 now, and then sometimes it's covered and sometimes it's not. So any do you hear any feedback from your colleagues about the insurance companies and working with them, and is there anything we can do to make that any easier?
Well, I actually, our pharmacy does billing, same as any other pharmacy. The nightmare that long-term care pharmacy has faced has been on the federal level from CMS, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, and it's been the short cycle. So our pharmacy, as an institutional pharmacy, and we have to be an institutional pharmacy based on licensing requirements, can only dispense up to a 14-day supply at a time. And that hasn't, which results in copay issues and so on and so forth. And it's not the way that the feds meant for it to all shake out, but that has been somewhat ridiculous. But prior to that, we could dispense a 30-day supply at a time. So, you know, there are just rules that you have to follow. The important thing that I have learned is that you have to do every claim correctly the very first time. You're never sloppy with your work. It is so important, and I think that any pharmacy needs to have a competent person typing through prescriptions and doing the billing. Billing is done at point of sale in most pharmacies. And so you submit the claim as you're dispensing the medication, and you receive feedback within seconds from the insurance company. And the claim is either accepted or denied. But then maybe a year later, you'll get audited on that claim, and you have to go dig out all the info and do the research. It is my practice and the practice of most everybody that you just have to do proper business practices and make sure that you're billing a claim correctly every time. The rules are ridiculous sometimes. They don't make sense, and every insurance company can have their own set of rules. But for the most part, the insurance companies give you immediate feedback, and if they don't like the way you set up the claim to submit it with overrides and so on and so forth, they'll tell you. What they've done now with expensive medications is there's a prior authorization process that brings in the provider, the prescriber of the drug, and so there's additional paperwork for them. We're saving the insurance company money perhaps by doing that, but it's a real burden on the pharmacy and the provider. Most providers I know have hired professional people just to do business with insurance companies. And the reimbursements are lower than they've ever been. And so there's not enough money to to give them all the information and the feedback and be audited. And I just got an audit, and we do this all the time. It's just in the course of business. And they had maybe 250 prescriptions. They wanted us to send them a copy of the prescription and then dispensing information. Well, I mean, that's going to take me a whole day to go dig out those prescriptions, or a staff person, you know. We're not paid for that. They're not paying us for that. And dispensing fees might be 25 cents. So that 25 cents did not cover the dispensing and the extra work. So, I could go on and on all day about that. But, that's out of control, too. third-party billing's terrible.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gardner?
Thank you. The 14-day limit, is that because you're in the Pioneer home? Is it because of the particular medications? Or
it's a long-term care rule by center by Medicare. It's a Medicare rule ruling.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, maybe they're anticipating short-term, long-term care. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Is there anyone online who or in the room that would like to provide public testimony on Lana's nomination to continue serving on the board? Okay, seeing none, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate you taking time to answer our questions. It's been a learning experience, and
it's true.
I think we may actually be seeking your expert advice because we do have a lot of bills that, that deal with your profession. So thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
Next, from Eagle River, Terrell Giesel. She is also a governor's nominee to the Board of Pharmacy for the public seat. And Terrell, I see that you're online, and please feel free to introduce yourself to the committee and express your interest in serving on this board.
Hi, my name's Terrell. I'm so sorry that I was late on this line. I got caught up with my children. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a homemaker from Eagle River, and I have served one term on the Board of Pharmacy already in the second public member seat. I originally did not intend to be on the board. I was placed on there by Governor Parnell when I was seeking a different board appointment, but I have grown to love the profession so much and really have great respect for the professionals that I work with. This is an excellent board, and we are doing a lot to further public safety in the state, as well as the protection of the profession. My interest as a public member is more on the public safety side, so I try to provide some context from a middle-class consumer standpoint and not the professionals. Also, in the bills that the board has been putting forward, my interest lies in how we can make those best serve the public without overly tying the hands of the professionals who have been educated and are practicing in this field. I've learned as much from them, probably more so than I think they ever learned from me as a member of the public. They're wonderful. I would like to serve on the board again. If that is the will of the Senate, that would be great. Do you have any questions for me? I'm pretty straightforward.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Terrell? Okay, seeing none, there are no questions. Thank you so much for making yourself available. Is there anyone here in Juneau or online that wishes to provide public testimony regarding Terrell's appointment? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. Next, we have James Henderson calling in from Soldotna. James is also a nominee for the Board of Pharmacy for the pharmacist seat. James, please feel free to introduce yourself to the committee and let us know your interest in serving on the board.
Hey, my name is James Henderson. I'm a pharmacist. I have been here in Alaska for 10 years. I've been a pharmacist for 22 years. I have been in retail most of that time. Till about 3 years ago, I purchased professional home IV, which is what we call a home infusion pharmacy. So I'm no longer really on that front line of retail, but I do something a little different, and I really enjoyed that. I was approached to serve on the board, and figured that that would be a great way to do some civic service and also help shape my profession at the same time. So I'm pretty excited to be able to be a part of that.
Well, thank you very much. Are there any questions of committee members for James? Okay, James, there's no questions for you. Thank you for making yourself available and for your willingness to serve the state in this capacity. Is there anyone here in Juneau or online that wishes to provide public testimony related to James's nomination? Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Next, we have the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers. This is a five-member board. The nominee that we will hear from today, actually, let me skip ahead. That nominee is not available. So we will be hearing from Renee Pizchek of Fairbanks at some future date related to that board. But now we'll move on to the State Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors. And so, members, you have a tab in your packet that shows the members that we'll be hearing from today that have been nominated either for the first time, or we have two that are reappointments. So with that, I'd like to welcome Elizabeth Johnston of Fairbanks. This is the electrical engineer.
This is Elizabeth Johnston, and I am here because I am seeking to join the State Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors. I'm a registered electrical engineer and a registered fire protection engineer, which are two of the disciplines that the board governs for our professional practice and registration. And do you have any questions for me?
Thank you, Elizabeth. Are there any questions of committee members? I'm going to take a brief at ease. Johnson of Fairbanks. She is the nominee for the electrical engineer seat on the Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors Board. And Elizabeth, I was curious, do you see any challenges that the board is going to be facing in the next year that you anticipate, or maybe challenges that you guys have been dealing with lately?
Sure. I am new to the board, so I can only speak from what I've been reading on their agendas for the last several years. And one issue that I see is they're debating the inclusion of software engineering as a new form of registration in our state. And my degree is actually in electrical engineering with a computer engineering focus. So I'll be interested to see how that gets debated. What aspects are we going to mandate that they be registered to perform engineering services for? Is it just going to be life safety aspects of computer engineering, or is this going to be all computer engineering, which could potentially have a burden on people who are in that field right now that aren't currently registered? So that will be an interesting thing to watch get debated.
Thank you. That is very interesting. That's the first time that I've heard of that issue. Are there any further questions of committee members? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Elizabeth, and we will keep your case, or whatever you want to call it, open with the rest of them, and we'll be forwarding you as a group through the process. And with that, I want to know, is there anyone here in Juneau or online that wishes to provide public testimony on Elizabeth Johnston's nomination? Okay, seeing none. Next, I'd like to welcome Richard Jones of, it says Anchorage here, but Juneau, so are you here?
Yes, I'm calling in from...
Oh, okay, thank you. And so your nomination is for the public seat on the Board of Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors, the State Board of Registration for those professions. So please feel free to introduce yourself to the committee and let us know why you're interested in serving.
Yes, I'm Richard Jones, retired from the state of Alaska. I worked in professional licensing, and I worked with the board for several years. Enjoy working with them. The service they provide is a valuable service. I'm also well aware of the importance of having an outside perspective from time to time, and that's who I am. I would like to serve.
Okay. Thank you very much. And are there any questions from the committee members? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone here in Juneau or anyone online who wishes to testify on the nomination of Richard Jones? Okay, thank you very much for calling in. I appreciate you taking time and your interest in serving the state in this capacity. So with that, committee members, we were planning on hearing from John Kerr, who has been nominated to the land surveyor seat for this board, and also Jeffrey Kuntz, the architect seat, but neither one are available to call in today. So we will take a brief at ease and invite Senator Giesel's staff forward to present Senate Bill 56. But before I take the at ease, I just again want to thank the members of the public who provide their time and effort and expertise and attention to the boards that they serve on. There are over 200 boards in the state of Alaska, and many of these are really significant in terms of managing different professions across the state. So with that, we'll take a brief at ease. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order. Next on our agenda, we have Senate Bill 56, which is an act relating to product warranties and services for certain products. And with us, we have Ike Gilopsis and Senator Giesel. Welcome, and thank you for making yourself available to the committee. I know it's a busy time of year, and appreciate you presenting your bill to us. So with that, please feel free to introduce the bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Kathy Giesel, Senate District N. Thank you so much for hearing the bill. So Senate Bill 56 is about the protections for small businesses and consumers. So the question with all of these bills is, why? The free market principles have brought great prosperity, technical advances, and a thriving middle class to America and to Alaska. Government can protect an environment where business and commerce can thrive. That's my goal with this bill. This bill is about contractual rights between private parties, between the manufacturer, the local business vendor, and the Alaskan consumer. There are five legal elements to consider in a fair contract. The element under consideration in this bill is the absence of any form of duress by any contracting party. The issue before us happens when one party in a contract has no effective ability to negotiate with the other party. In this bill, we address the one party, the large mega company that's a manufacturer, and the other party being the local Alaskan franchise business. The instigating source of the duress is Alaska's formidable geography. To reiterate the point of effective negotiation on a contract, allow me to explain. When an Alaskan business elects to become a vendor of an outside manufactured product, they take on sunk costs. I know you probably talk about that a lot. You're talking about the economy, Madam Chair. Sunk costs are in the form of the product that is purchased as inventory, so whatever it is they're selling, the inventory. In this case, it's heavy equipment in this bill, which is an expensive sunk cost. The vendor also has to pay for the necessary facility space to comply with the agreement with the manufacturer. They also take on the updates that are required by the manufacturer and the repair of the equipment that comes under warranty. The Alaska business and customer have to resolve the issues of logistics to provide that warranty work. This means, or could mean, shipping the heavy equipment back to the vendor location for repair, or the vendor sending the repair technician to the remote site. The remote site might be Kodiak, the North Slope, or Chicken, Alaska. The duress occurs when the vendor is not adequately compensated by the manufacturer for the full cost of the warranty work. The purchaser has sunk costs as well in the purchase of the heavy equipment, which was very expensive, shipment to the work site, and now lost work time due to defective equipment. Sometimes there are equipment updates that must be done to meet the requirements of a warranty. These updates must be done by a licensed dealer of that equipment, but the equipment is at a remote site, off-road, requiring significant travel for technicians or equipment to reach that site. If the manufacturer fails to pay the full cost of meeting the warranty requirements, we have another situation in which fair contract elements are in question. Moreover, those requirements are included when the agreement between the local vendor and the manufacturer are updated. I ask, how could a vendor who has incurred significant sunk cost be an effective negotiator when they may disagree with the reimbursement rates of a national manufacturer that has exclusivity on that brand of equipment? While most of our Alaska manufacturers are ethical, reputable companies, you'll see a letter from Associated General Contractors in your packet that raises past issues about lemons. That is equipment that was substandard being shipped to Alaska based on the expectation that when the equipment fails, the purchaser will not make the effort to ship the equipment back to claim the warranty. When a customer purchases heavy equipment from a local Alaskan business, they do so with the understandable expectation that the equipment will function as stated. They also understandably purchase a warranty to ensure a warranty is included, or ensure that a warranty is included in the purchase price for these inherently expensive products. Again, this bill is about contractual rights between private parties, between the manufacturers, the local business vendor, as well as the protection for the Alaskan consumer. Senate Bill 56 ensures that there is the same equitable treatment for Alaska consumers and vendors as there is for other states. We are unique. We say that a lot because it's true. We have work sites that are very rural where no approved warranty service providers are available. Provisions should exist in Alaska law that ensures that Alaska vendors and consumers are truly protected by fair warranty contracts, and that the spirit of the warranty, to fix what is defective, is honored. Online is the Department of Law prepared to flesh this out in more detail, and there are also folks directly affected by the disparity that currently exists. My staff is present to take you through a sectional of the bill as you wish, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, and I would appreciate a sectional, Ikey.
Madam Chair, for the record, Ikey Gulopso, staff to Senator Giesel, and a 2016 season ticket holder to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee room. Glad to be back.
With have you liked our Facebook page? Okay. That's what.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, with your permission, I'll go through a sectional analysis, answer whatever questions are within my capacity to do so, and gracefully punt those that are not to the Department of Law and the other relevant field members. Madam Chair, this bill has 8 pages, and Section 1 of the bill covers pages 1 through 7, so with your indulgence, I'll do what would be called a subsectional analysis of Section 1 to be able to take the committee through that. So Section 1 goes through page 1 through 7, and subsection 1 would create a proposed Alaska statute 4545772. And that can be found on page 1, line 6, continuing through to page 2, line 9. And this outlines the requirements of a dealer. And for the purposes of this sectional, Madam Chair, the term dealer means dealer or distributor, whereas in the bill it says dealer and distributor. This is just done for being succinct and brevity in the sectional analysis. But it would require a dealer to provide any of the provisions that's outlined in a manufacturer's warranty that was in effect at the time of sale to the affected ultimate purchaser. And it also outlines the obligations of each party when that contractor does provide the warranty service. The next proposed section would be in 4545773, which can be found on page 2, line 10, continuing to line 15. And that requires a dealer to properly explain the warranty coverage and the disclaimers and the limitations to the ultimate provider. And it also prohibits that dealer from making a representation about warranty that's actually not in the worded warranty that's provided by the manufacturer. Continuing on to 4545774, that can be found also on page 2, beginning on line 16 and continuing to line 19. And this also requires a dealer to provide warranty service, as well as to make claims for reimbursement and warranty work in a manner that's been established by that national manufacturer. Continuing to proposed 4545775, Madam Chair, beginning on page 2, line 20, continuing through to line 24, this would prohibit a manufacturer from restricting the nature or the extent of labor or the parts that are needed to perform the work that are in accordance with the generally accepted standards. Then, Madam Chair, you have 4545776, and that begins on page 2, line 25, and that continues through line 28. And this requires a manufacturer to follow a process that's outlined in this bill later in the standard industry claim procedures when paying a dealer or distributor for those required services. Madam Chair, that then takes the committee to 4545777, and that begins on page 2, line 29, and that continues to page 3, line 20, and this establishes the minimum compensation rubric for work that's performed by a dealer on behalf of the manufacturer for the warranty work, and that also specifies the minimum time and the labor cost rates. And it also requires that manufacturer to pay for the transportation and lodging costs if the dealer needs to send an employee out into the field to perform work, as the Senator Giesel's sponsor statement alluded. Continuing to propose section 4545778, beginning on page 3, line 21, and then ending on page 3, line 24. This is a proposed requirement for a manufacturer to reimburse a dealer for parts that are used and at the manufacturer's full suggested retail price. On page 2 of the sectional analysis, Madam Chair, this would go next to proposed section 4545779, and that begins on page 3 of the bill, line 25, continuing to page 4, line 4. And that specifies that if a part that's needed is not actually in the dealer's inventory, the manufacturer is required to actually pay the cost and send that item, and that would be at the discretion of the ultimate purchaser to have that item shipped either to the dealer's location where the purchase occurred, or to the nearest dealer located closest to the purchaser, whichever one is closer for the purchaser. Then on proposed section 4545780, Madam Chair, which would begin on page 4, line 5, and that continues to page 4, line 11, this requires the manufacturer to pay or disapprove a claim within 30 days, or it would be considered an approved claim, and then that claim would accrue a penalty of 1.5% per month. And then, Madam Chair, 4545781 of the proposed section 1 is found on page 4, line 12, and then that continues to line 15. And that requires that a manufacturer's claim disapproval to be in writing and issued within 30 days of receipt of that claim. Madam Chair, still staying within section 1, this takes us to the next provision that Senator Geese alluded to, which are the Lemon Law provisions that are found within this bill, and that begins with proposed section 4545782, beginning on page 4, line 16, continuing through line 21, and this requires the manufacturer or the dealer to repair a product defect that's covered under the warranty when it's reported by the purchaser. And then on proposed 4545783, beginning on line 22 of page 4, continuing to page 5, line 22, this stipulates that if a reasonable number of attempts during the first year of the warranty purchase has been undertaken, or I should say a reasonable number of attempts have been taken, or 1 year has transpired since the reported defect from the ultimate purchaser, whichever occurs first, that manufacturer either has to replace that product with a new comparable product or refund an amount equal to the full purchase price minus a reasonable amount for the period that the purchaser was able to use that product. And in that same language, Madam Chair, is the inherent answer to an inherent question, which is what defines reasonable, and it outlines what that reasonable depreciation rate would be for the monetary amount. And that purchaser can choose whether to get a new product or a refund based on that rubric. It also outlines that calculation. And then, Madam Chair, proposed section 4545784, which begins on page 5, line 23, continuing to page 6, line 9, that establishes a process for the ultimate purchaser of the product to make a claim under that previous proposed section that we just alluded to. And the purchaser has to make a written claim, and it has to be sent by certified mail to the manufacturer within 60 days of the end of the term of the warranty, or 1 year after the purchase date, and it has to be whichever one comes first. And that would outline what needs to be in the written claim that's in this language, and it also allows the manufacturer to make a final attempt to fix that item within 30 days of receipt of that claim from the ultimate purchaser. Continuing, Madam Chair, to proposed section 4545785, beginning on page 6, line 10, continuing to line 20. This is language that would state that the manufacturer does not have to replace or refund a claimed product defect if the claim is either not a defect that's a result of an alteration or abuse or neglect by the purchaser. Basically, if you actually busted it, it was outside of a warranty. Manufacturer is not responsible for user error. And then, Madam Chair, the last new proposed language under Section 1 would be 4545786, and that's found on page 6, beginning on line 21, continuing to page 7, line 2. And that creates a rebuttable presumption that if the product had been in the shop for repairs 3 separate times or for 30 days during the warranty period or the first year of ownership, or whichever is shorter, a reasonable number of attempts to fix that product has been made. So in allusion to the earlier language of 4545783 of what's a reasonable number, that's giving that definition to what reasonable would be. Madam Chair, 4545787 and 788 found on page 7 going from line 3 to line 15, those outline the definitions of what products would be covered by this legislation. And for the committee's edification, those products include items such as items primarily used for construction, road building, snow removal, mining, oil projects, gas projects, forestry, resource development, or similar type of project. And in that section, Madam Chair, the motor vehicle means that it's a motor vehicle that's not subject to registration under Alaska Statute 2810.011. Madam Chair, that takes us to Section 2 of the bill, and that would amend the definition of merchandise in Alaska Statute 45790 to include the definition of covered products that was just mentioned. And Section 3 of the bill would add definitions to 45790 for the other terms used in this legislation, reasonable amount of time, purchase, and so forth. Section 4, Madam Chair, would add the violations to the provisions that would be proposed in Section 1 to the list of unfair methods of competition and unfair or deceptive acts or practices that are found in Alaska Statute 4550471, and that is on page 8, line 23, continuing to line 25. And finally, Madam Chair, Section 4 of the bill is an applicability provision, and that just specifies that this bill would apply to agreements into or on the effective date of this act. And that is the sectional analysis, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Aiki. Are there questions from committee members?
Madam Chair.
We'll begin with Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you. This is very interesting. And of course, I want to protect my consumers, the people who live in Kodiak, and my entire district. But I just wonder now, could a manufacturer say it's no longer worth doing business in Alaska because now I have to travel out to Cold Bay and send my technicians out there and transport all my equipment and my repair equipment and things I might need? I mean, I can see where you're going with this. That makes a lot of sense. But is there a cost? Is there a potential that, say, a Caterpillar would say, I can't afford to do business in Alaska. I can afford to do business in Oregon, where I can drive to places, but now I have to travel to Cold Bay to repair this piece of equipment. I mean, is there a downside to this, Senator?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, Senator Giesel speaking. This is not the manufacturer traveling to these remote locations. It's actually the vendor. So let's say the scenario is a vendor in Anchorage who is now under warranty required to travel to that location or ship that heavy piece of equipment back to Anchorage to repair. At the way it stands right now, they are under obligation to do that because of the warranty. But the manufacturer, who may be located in New Jersey, we'll just pick that location, can say, well, we're not going to pay the full cost of that because it's too much. So that leaves the Alaska vendor, who let's say we said was located in Anchorage, carrying those extra costs. So that's what this bill is meant to remedy, that the manufacturer must agree to cover those full costs. There's also probably some other cost-saving measures that could be come up with, you know, in those scenarios. But at this point, those options aren't available.
Thank you. I appreciate that explanation, and I certainly want to protect the Alaska vendor as well. But I guess my real concern is, would the manufacturer then decide, because I have to pick up he now has to pick up those costs, the vendor, is there a downside? Is there if I were Caterpillar, would I say, can't afford to do business in Alaska, and have we really affected our industry? I mean, I guess whose fault is it? I mean, I understand it's not the vendors, but if you choose to take these equipment out to Cold Bay instead of using it in Anchorage, you are adding enormous expenses that the manufacturer or the vendor would have to cover. I'm just asking if this could do us some harm.
Senator Stevens, through the chair. The idea that Caterpillar would decide they didn't want to work on our North Slope or at the Dutch Harbor airport that is having new construction, that's certainly their choice. This is a free country. I don't believe it is Caterpillar's intent to manufacture defective equipment, but it is also their intent to have their equipment serviced properly and to be a reputable firm in our state. So you can certainly, there will be local businesses who are vendors, right, online. You can certainly pose those questions to them to get an on-the-ground real sense of how that might play out. Thank you for the question, however.
I appreciate the discussion.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Gardner?
I guess I just want to say I share that concern. It's the unintended consequences, and it may be that, you know, they would at some point, some manufacturers are going to say, I'm not going to sell in Alaska, and if an Alaskan wants to buy this equipment, they have to come to Seattle to do it, and we will say the warranty is valid in Washington or in the lower 48 or something like that. I think that's something to be worried about. But my question is, on page 7, where there's, I guess, it's section 4545, 787, the products covered, if this is a good idea for all of these products, why wouldn't we just apply it to everything in Alaska?
For the record, Ike Yalopsis, staff to Senator Giesel. Madam Chair, Senator Gardner, this legislation was introduced by the sponsor at the request of some of the affected stakeholders that specifically work with off-road manufacturing and dealer issues. Secondly, this language is based off of the legislation that was passed in 2009 when all-terrain vehicles, boats, and other off-road pieces of machinery such as snow machines were brought under coverage for warranty service and remote reasons for some of the same criticisms and issues that Senator Stevens alluded to. And the Senator's understanding of the minutes from back in 2009 was that the attempt was made very clear, the intent, excuse me, in the legislature to delineate the discussion between items that are registered for being on the road because of the separate types of titles being in Title 28 and so forth, and those that are specifically off-road in their guiding principles.
Senator Gardner?
Thank you. I guess my question is, what about somebody who buys, say, a commercial refrigerator for a business in Cold Bay? What a big, heavy refrigerator. It's not licensed. It's not a vehicle. But the principle of insisting that the warranty be upheld by the manufacturer and that the dealer is not responsible for transporting whatever it is that is under warranty or providing somebody to go out to the site to take care of it. I mean, why should it be just limited to materials involved in resource development or construction?
Madam Chair, Senator Gardner, the individuals who be available to testify would be able to speak to the specificity of the relationship with industrial commercial pieces of equipment between a distributor or dealer with the manufacturer, in contrast to, say, the purchase of a home appliance from a big box store that doesn't actually provide a warranty, but it's a direct through the manufacturer warranty, where, for example, a wholesale provider such as a Costco or a comparable entity would have that piece of equipment provided on sale. That nature of the purchase is different for a couple of reasons. One is the exclusivity clause for some of the franchise holders and dealers for some of the required updates in the equipment they have to take, whereas there might be a separate purchase refund policy with a retail business. And so that starts taking the legislation or the topic into several segments that are very different from the type of products that are here covered. Where there are similarities, the differences become much more numerous. And it was the sponsor's intent to make the legislation as it was introduced more narrowly tailored along those sets of products.
Thank you.
Senator Gardner?
I have a whole bunch of questions,
no,
but
certainly,
there's a lot of depth. So I guess in Section 1, going down to, page 3, line 1. Section 1. I was writing as fast as I could to get here. Are these provisions that start there, Section B, C, D, are they the same in other parts of the country, or is this unique for Alaska?
Madam Chair, Senator Gardner, that's an excellent question that I will not be able to answer to you. But we do have Mr. Seward that is affiliated with CMI, as well as Mr. Sniffen, I believe, Madam Chair, Senator Gardner, with the Department of Law, who's in the Consumer Protection Division. Mm-hmm. And they may have a more nationwide and cross-jurisdictional knowledge than I do.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Gardner. Feel free to continue.
So we'll hold that until later. Madam Chair, is that your intention?
Yes.
Okay. Section E. I guess this one is something that I have the same sort of question about, where the dealer or distributor would be responsible for transportation and lodging costs for the employers of the dealer. I'm thinking of someplace like Hawaii or some other state that has remote sites that the vendor might have to send an employee out there. So I guess I'm interested to know if this is unique for Alaska, something we're inventing ourselves here. Okay. I guess a lot of my questions have to do with that. Is this something that's done elsewhere? We had another similar bill recently with lots of maps of the country and places where these provisions applied or didn't.
Madam Chair,
Senator Giesel.
Senator Giesel, for the record, Senator Gardner, through the chair, we all recognize that Alaska has a very limited road system, and so it is impossible to compare Indiana and the challenges there. They have remote areas as well, to Alaska's remote areas, which can only be reached by air. So that's something to keep in mind also. It is, in fact, true that Alaska is different.
Yes, very much so. Thank you. In section, Madam Chair, let's see, page 6, section 4545785, it deals with exceptions. And the ultimate purchaser may not receive a refund if the product is claimed to have a defect, if the manufacturer shows the problem or condition is not a defect or resulted from alteration. So if a manufacturer is in Detroit, and how does the manufacturer show that? They have to send somebody to Alaska, to Cold Bay, to make that determination? Can they? Is that how that would work?
For the record, Ike Gilopsis, staff to Senator Giesel. Madam Chair, Senator Gardner, I would defer to the folks that would be online that could give you those very specific case studies.
Okay. Thank you. I guess all my questions kind of have those same themes.
I'm going to take a brief at ease. Committee is called back to order. And we have online Ed Sniffen with the Attorney General's Office. Ed, can you hear us?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Would you be interested in responding to Senator Gardner's questions? And then following that, we have questions from Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ed Sniffen with the Department of Law. To some of the questions I think Senator Gardner was asking, we are not aware of what other states do with these types of lemon laws for big construction equipment. So, you know, we're not able to speak to how other states might have addressed this. I suspect that some of the dealers who are online to testify may have a more comprehensive understanding of how this is dealt with in other states. But I'd be happy to answer the questions if the committee has any, Madam Chair.
Senator Gardner?
Not right now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We also have Cindy Franklin online, who's with also with the Attorney General's Office. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is for the sponsor. I'm just wondering, looking at the list on page 7, line 7, all the different things, it makes me think of our state DOT. Are they going to be able, will they benefit from this, and could there be a savings to the state? Because right now they're covering the cost, and would it be helpful in that way?
Senator Hughes, through the chair. I can't answer that question specifically right now. I don't know if the State Department of Transportation goes through a local Alaska vendor to purchase equipment, or if they go directly to the manufacturer. So let me examine that and get back to you with an answer. Thank you. That's a good question.
And follow up?
Senator Hughes?
And if it would, I would suggest to make sure that the list is complete, because they use equipment for spreading gravel, for sweeping roads, other things than just the building, and to make sure the repair equipment, you know, paving, everything is covered there if it would apply. I think it would be a good idea.
Thank you. Okay. I have a question for Ed Sniffen. Mr. Sniffen, this committee just last week, I think, heard a bill related to auto dealers and manufacturers, and now we're looking again at a relationship that up until, you know, for the most part is handled through contract law. And I'm curious what the failure is, why contract law is not able to address some of these concerns that have prompted the sponsor to come forward with this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure I can answer that question. I believe that most of these franchise relationships, you know, start out with the contract negotiations you speak of, and then over time, I think for reasons the sponsor had explained, there's a relationship that develops where there are a lot of expenses and costs spent by the dealers to have their business, and it becomes sort of an adhesion contract in a sense where they just don't have a lot of bargaining power with the manufacturers that provide the products they have to sell. I believe that's why in some cases you have states that have auto franchise laws, for example, like Alaska does, and perhaps you know, a number of other states. But for the most part, I think these kinds of issues are, I think the parties at least attempt to address them through their contract negotiations.
Thank you. Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Smith. And so I understand that, you know, maybe a large piece of equipment, there'd always be a warranty on it. If a manufacturer found that it was too expensive to provide warranty coverage in Alaska because the equipment is in Cold Bay, we keep picking on, but could a manufacturer declare that a warranty is not covered in areas far away?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that's a good question. That would be difficult, I think, for a manufacturer to do if they sell a piece of equipment into a state where they know the equipment is likely to be transported to some remote area. I would think that the warranties generally follow the equipment, you know, unless there's some specific, you know, exemption by the manufacturer that says if you take this piece of equipment to, you know, 200 miles away from a dealer, your warranty no longer applies. So they would have to have some very clearly stated exception to the warranty to not cover it. So I think they would be required to probably provide that service.
Senator Stevens, do you have any further questions?
I think it's simply economics. As I remember from college economics, I mean, if you cost you more to do business, you find a way to not do it. And I think, actually, I appreciate Senator Gardner's comment about unintended consequences. I wasn't clever enough to come up with that phrase, but I think it's absolutely right that it seems to me, Mr. Smithen, that that there could be some unintended consequences here, and you do not appear to agree with that.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, no, we're not saying that. I'm saying that there might be, for example, in the warranty issue, if there was this unintended consequence that the manufacturer didn't expect, they may get stuck with that bill and not knowingly, and then maybe next time they would have to restructure the warranties in a way to account for that. So, no, hard to say what the consequences of this legislation might be.
Thank you, Mr. Smithen.
Senator Hughes?
I don't know if you're going to be able to answer this. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just based on Senator Gardner's concern and Senator Stevens' concern, how many dollars are we talking about? What, on an annual basis, statewide, how much are the dealers absorbing, well, passing on to consumers because the law is the way it is today? What, can you give us a ballpark?
Senator Hughes, through the chair, this is Senator Giesel. First of all, I think that the answer to that question can be answered by the franchise dealers that are on the phone willing to testify. And I would also say that I have heard them say they don't pass that on to the consumer. they absorb that cost as Alaskan businesses themselves. And therein lies the problem.
I'm going to take a brief at ease. Labor and Commerce is called back to order, and Senator Giesel, did you have any follow-up to that question?
No, I do not. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Stevens? Mr. Snippen, I have one comment or question. This is Senator Costello. Are there current obligations that are in state statute related to manufacturers and lemon laws? I mean, most of this legislation is new law. And I'm just curious, is there any, is there nothing related to this in current statute?
Madam Chair, the analogous provisions, I think Senator Giesel may have referenced this earlier, there's, or it might have been Ike, we have an ATV lemon law that was enacted in 2009 that itself was predicated on our just automobile lemon law. And those are the only two lemon law protections for consumers that I'm aware of in Alaska law. We do have a current distributorship law that's found in Alaska statute, Title 45700, and that protects distributors of all products, and it's not limited to this kind of construction equipment, from certain practices by manufacturers. If they terminate a relationship, they have to buy back their inventory and, you know, do a few things. But other than those, I'm not aware of any specific things that would address the things that this particular bill is trying to address.
Thank you. And a follow-up to that, so these issues then, I mean, again, the committee's heard similar legislation just last week, and it's my understanding that traditionally a lot of these issues can be dealt with in the contract, but apparently that we're having some that we have to pull out, and the legislature is having to sort of be the referee or set the guidelines for?
Madam Chair, yeah, I think that was a theme that you might have heard on Senate Bill 47, where the automobile dealers are trying to enact some modifications to the current franchise laws that address those relationships. This bill, though, does not have the retroactivity provision, so you know, it would only apply to new contracts going forward. So for contracts that are currently in place, it wouldn't affect those contracts.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, well, thank you very much, Senator Giesel. Appreciate you being here in person, and Ike for that review. So in the room, I'm going to open up the public testimony. We do have a number of people online, and just want you to be aware that the committee does end at 3:30. So I'd like to invite Chris Drondale up. Certainly, you've been waiting here patiently. You're with the Construction Machinery and Industrial. Please feel free to provide your testimony to the committee, and feel free to comment on any of the issues that you heard.
Thank you. I am Chris Drondale with Construction Machinery and Industrial. I was born and raised in Anchorage and have lived in Juneau since 2004. Also online is CMI's counsel, Steve Seward. My family has been in the construction heavy equipment industry since the 1930s in Alaska. I have been since the 1990s. I currently, in addition to the work that I do for Construction Machinery, I do contract work for other heavy equipment contractors and a couple of mines in southeast Alaska. So I see this issue from both sides. Senate Bill 56 is addressing some of the uncovered costs with warranties and product updates, heavy equipment that are passed on to the end user in Alaska. Both warranties and product updates, the manufacturer doesn't cover, for both warranties and product updates, the manufacturer doesn't cover all labor or freight associated with these repairs. Senate Bill 56 still does not require the manufacturers to cover all freight or labor associated with these repairs, but does require them to cover a higher percentage than they are currently covering. As an example, manufacturers still will not have to pay for the travel labor to get to Cold Bay or somewhere else. Heavy equipment warranties are similar to other warranties you're probably familiar with. While product updates are when there is a manufacturing defect or common failure with such a high occurrence, the manufacturer has determined that a repair is necessary. Product updates are often issued years after the warranties have expired. In both of these cases, the manufacturer is not required to cover all labor or freight associated with these repairs. For large companies that are large consumers of heavy equipment, this is not as much of an issue because they have the power the power to tell the manufacturers to cover these additional costs, or they will take their business elsewhere. but small contractors, farmers, loggers, and plaster miners don't have the same ability to put that pressure on the manufacturers. When there is a potential warranty failure, for the problem needs to be diagnosed, and the end user will have to pay the airfare, travel labor, and travel costs to get the problem diagnosed. If it is determined to be a warranty failure, then the part is ordered on a stock order in which it could take 4 weeks for the part to get to Alaska. 4 weeks in Alaska could be 15 to 20% of the construction season, and most of the contractors, miners, farmers, loggers, can't deal with having a piece of equipment down for that long. So they will pay the expedited freight themselves to get the part to Alaska so that the piece of equipment can get fixed in a timely manner under the warranty and get it back into use. Once that part does arrive, they will again have to pay the airfare, travel labor, and travel costs to have the mechanic come back out and fix a piece of equipment at that time. The consequences can be on a $4,000 to $5,000 warranty work order, the manufacturer might only cover $500 of it. Product updates are problematic in a similar yet slightly more concerning way. These are situations in which the manufacturer has determined there is a failure of such high occurrence and needs to be repaired before it will most likely fail, or it needs to be repaired because it is a safety issue. And I can provide some examples of the cost associated with the product updates and what the manufacturers do cover and don't cover. The cost again can easily reach $3,000 to $4,000 on a repair that will only take 2 hours. Yet the manufacturer will only cover that 2 hours plus maybe $450 of travel costs. The rest of that cost burden is put on the end user or the vendor. By sending out the product update, the manufacturer has already acknowledged a shortcoming in the engineering of the equipment that requires an update. Why is the manufacturer putting the burden of paying for this engineering mistake on the end user? So who does the bill benefit? The bill benefits the small and medium-sized users of equipment in Alaska. This group includes the everyday, this group works every day and doesn't have the staff for government affairs. I encourage you to keep this in mind when you read the letters of support for SB 56. These are people who hire Alaskans and spend their money in Alaska. The passing of SB 56 will allow the small contractors, farmers and loggers and plaster miners to focus that much more attention to their production and not burden them with all of the costs they might assume would be covered by warranty. The only opposition to this bill that I have heard comes from the manufacturers. They will argue that the additional cost is going to increase the price of equipment. The reality is the burden of the additional cost is currently being covered by the end user now. All this bill does is put some of the burden back on the manufacturer that built a piece of equipment that needs to be repaired. Council Steve Seward is online if you have questions for him. I also would encourage you to look and see, this was tailored after the ATV and boat bill, and how many of those manufacturers have pulled out since that bill has come into effect in 2009.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions of committee members? Senator Gardner.
Thank you, and I don't know if you can answer this, but can you tell me where the product updates are covered in the bill?
Steve? Steve Seward's online. Steve, do you have the section that they're covered in?
Yeah, I'm just looking for the specific reference, Chris.
Just take a brief at ease. And our last few minutes looking for that, Senator Gardner will receive that.
Okay, and I have found it. It's you can see it on page 8, line 12, as part of the definition of required service.
Steve, do you mind stating your name and representation for the committee? And we have people listening in online, so they're not able to necessarily discern who's actually speaking.
Yeah, sorry, Madam Chair. This is Steve Seward, and I'm the attorney with Construction Machinery. Been involved with them for the last 15 years.
Okay, any further questions?
788.
All right, well, thank you very much for testifying in front of the committee. Appreciate it. Next, I'd like to invite Jim Halloran with Caterpillar, calling in from Sacramento. And, Jim, we have about 5 minutes left in the committee and others who want to testify. I'm not sure we'll get to everyone, but just wanted to let you know.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that, and I will not filibuster over this. I'll just be very quick because I'd really like to hand my time over to Nikki Aksik. But there were two comments that I just wanted to comment on, actually three. Number one, NC Machinery and Caterpillar have had an agreement in place now since 1926, and to date we haven't had an issue with that. So unlike one of the comments made earlier, they too are in agreement to our opposition on this bill. Number two, the question was said that Alaska is unique. Our agreements are global, so I really doubt that the differences between what we face in Alaska and sub-Saharan Africa are really that distinct. So, and then lastly, Madam Chair, your comments concerning contracts, I would just go back to that what we see here, our contract has allowed us to service our customers in Alaska for over 90 years, and we feel that we can handle that best with our dealer, NC Machinery. And so with that, I will yield back my time.
Okay.
Unless there's any questions, of course.
Yeah, are there any questions for Jim from the committee members? Senator Stevens.
Yeah, thanks. I know we're rushed here, but the comments that Chris made earlier about some of the burden would go back on the manufacturers. Can you help us understand that, how much of the burden goes back to the manufacturers from this bill?
I'm sorry, Senator, through the chair. You'll have to remind me on what that comment was. I apologize.
Chris, when you spoke earlier.
Are you speaking in terms of what we would do to address, say, a running change or something along those lines?
I guess I'm asking what's in this bill, and we heard the comment earlier that if you look at the bill, some of the burden is put back on the manufacturer, some of the burden. I'm just trying to get an idea of what is that burden, how burdensome is that to you?
Well, again, for us, it's a unique situation because what we do is, while we will pay for parts, we do not pay for time and travel. That is correct. But what we do is we'll discount the price of the machine to cover things like that. And the dealer appreciates that unique twist, because what happens is if there isn't a service required or something, the dealer can keep that. The dealer could provide that as an incentive for the customer to purchase the machine. So ours is a little bit unique, and that's why this bill would really alter, once again, a contract that's been in place for now over 90 years.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Next, Nick, calling in with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. Can you please provide your testimony and introduce yourself to the committee?
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Nick Aksik. I'm Senior Vice President with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. We represent over 950 companies that produce and manufacture off-road highway equipment. In the interest of time, and we greatly appreciate the opportunity to provide some comments, we are currently at a major trade show here. 2 years ago, we were able to come up to the state and to provide testimony in person, but the schedule prevents it today. I'd like to just make four quick comments and somewhat reinforce Jim Halloran of Caterpillar. Number one, throughout the discussion, it's ultimately, and that's why we're here in Vegas, is looking at customer satisfaction and supporting and working with the dealer as a partnership and the manufacturer to ensure that we have customer satisfaction. Number two is, I've yet to hear any kind of specific problems that have arisen by the dealers or in the state. And if so, what we prefer to do, instead of going through a legislative process, we prefer to work it directly with the dealer to try to resolve that issue between the manufacturer and the dealer. And third, again, as it's talked about, is the private contractual relationship that we believe this bill infringes on that relationship. And to my earlier point, we would prefer to work directly outside of the legislative process to find a solution in the end, ultimately to serve the customer. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Nick? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. I'm going to keep public testimony open because there are some individuals interested. However, we've run out of time today. The committee ends at 3:30. I did want to mention for members that on Tuesday we will hear Senate Bill 79, the governor's opioid database bill. We will hear Senate Bill 37, Senator Giesel's pharmacy board manufacturers bill. We will also hear Senate Bill 64, the Uniform Environmental Covenants, which is Senator Michiki's bill. So with that, I want to thank everyone for being here today, and we are adjourned.